All right. Good morning. Wednesday morning Bible study on the Gospel of John. We're going to get started in chapter 6 today, hopefully do about half of it. So last week we finished chapter 5. And chapter 5 was Jesus giving a little bit of a lecture at the end of it there, if you remember. Let me go back to it real quickly. He heals in the pools of Bethesda, the paralytic or the invalid, whatever we would want to say. And the Jews are all upset. And then he gives them this little sermon, sermonette, whatever, talking about himself and God. And there's some implications in there about the Trinity, which we did not delve too deeply into. But he does talk about working on the Sabbath. And, of course, God the Father still works on the Sabbath. Even though he's rested from his work of creation, he still works preserving and sustaining us. And then there's a passage of time. We don't know how long. So, in John 6, we start out, we'll delve right in. After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. Well, what's going on right before this was Jesus was in Jerusalem, arguing with the Jews about working on the Sabbath. He had just done a miracle. The pools of Bethesda, clearly, that's in Jerusalem, right by the sheep gate. So this is some time has passed, and now all of a sudden Jesus is back in Galilee. Some of the commentators wonder if, you know, there's a little bit glossed over here that Jesus, in the meantime, has gone back to Galilee. He's been there for some number of months, and most of the activity that took place is on the western side of the Sea of Galilee. So then now he's going over to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. That could be a possibility. One commentary I read said, well, this is actually a reference to travel all the way from Jerusalem. After he has this kind of debate with the Jews about working on the Sabbath and whether he is God or not, the Son of God, from Jerusalem he travels up the Jordan River Valley to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which would still put him in roughly the same place. So in either case, he goes to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. So there's an extra little comment, by the way, commentary from the Apostle John, for clarity, for the readers of the Gospel then. So he's writing 50 years after the time of Jesus. So the Sea of Tiberias, it must be, it is referred to by multiple different names. We usually say the Sea of Galilee. And verse 2, a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. There's that word signs again. John uses the word signs rather than miracles. And so why are the people following him? Because of his teaching? Because of his preaching? No. That's probably a better reason to follow him. But they're following him because he's healing the sick in a miraculous way. So, obviously this points out that Jesus did a lot more miracles than what's recorded for us in this and the other Gospels. Jesus did multiple miracles that we don't even know about. Now, let me look up real quick. I think I have a map, so we can kind of see where this is going on. Let me see if I put it in a convenient spot for myself. Bible studies. No. Bob, did you boot this up from scratch?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, it's not finding the network. Okay. Let me do one other thing real quick. I'm just going to do a search on the internet.
Yeah, I actually had to do a reboot because I wasn't sure if it was responding correctly.
Okay, there, this works. Let me click on this. So there, you can kind of see that map, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's the Sea of Galilee, and it below sea level as well, but not nearly as far below sea level as the Dead Sea, which is down south here. So the Jordan River connects these two. Actually, the Jordan River comes from up north, and it kind of winds down and fills the Sea of Galilee. There's some other small rivers that also feed the Sea of Galilee. And then the Jordan River, which is a bigger river south of it, flows downhill again into the Dead Sea, which is the lowest spot on earth. So there's the Sea of Galilee. There's Capernaum, which is on the northwest side of the Sea of Galilee. That was a major town. I'm not going to call it a city. It's not a city like Jerusalem, but a major town. It's kind of on a crossroads. There was a travel road that would go up this way up to Damascus. Also, from here, you could cut across through these valleys, the Megiddo Valley, and get out to the coast. So Capernaum is kind of on a crossroads. It was a fairly major city. Tiberias is also a fairly major city. We know that a little bit later in time, after the time of Jesus, some of the Roman governors built up Tiberias as a Roman town, a garrison, hence the name Tiberias. And there's Magdala, which is a minor village, but you know who came from Magdala?
Mary Magdalene,
hence the name. Gennesaret we hear a little bit about here and there. So most commentators think that Jesus went over here to this northeast side of the Sea of Galilee, and that's where he was preaching and teaching the people for the miracle that is about to happen, that we're going to read about. So up here, there's a fairly flat plain you can see, and then it starts to rise into mountains. And it's fairly green. This gets some rain during the year, and also the Sea of Galilee is a source of water, so and the rivers that are running into it. So it's a pleasant enough area. By the way, just to point out here, because it'll come up later in this story, Sea of Galilee is about, I put it in my notes, 7 miles wide by 13 miles long, I think, just in case you're interested. So it's a reasonably sized lake. They called it a sea. We would call it a lake because, you know, we have Lake Michigan next to us,
right?
Which is much bigger. Actually, when I was on the other side of the state, I would usually tell people, if you're familiar with that side of the state, I would say the Sea of Galilee would be similar to Lake St. Clair. Anybody familiar with the east side of the state?
Yeah.
A little bit? No? It's fine. It's the boring side of the state. We're on the good side of Michigan. The pretty side of Michigan.
Right.
Yeah, my family's kind of told me to stop saying that. It makes them feel bad. They all live over there. All right. So I'll close that. I'll leave that right there for the moment. All right. Back to this. So the crowds are following him. Now, you saw on that map, I mean, he's a little removed, a number of miles away from Capernaum and some of those villages, which are mostly on the north and northwest and western side of Galilee. The eastern side of Galilee is, other than that plain, that flat land to the northeast of Galilee, the eastern shore of Galilee rises fairly sharply into mountains and hills. So some of us will see that when we're there in Israel. So, yay. So Jesus went up on the mountain. Now, the mountains there, I should have gotten a picture of it. The mountains there are not, when I first think of mountains, I think of the Rockies. Mm-hmm. You know, with very sharp points, snow-capped a lot of times. The mountains there are more gentle in slope. Think of like a 45-degree angle, and they go up, and there's usually a flat or rounded top, and then they go down again. So they are mountains. They're like fairly high, a couple thousand feet.
Like the Appalachians, or?
Maybe more like the Appalachians, yeah. So if you're traveling to go up a mountain and over, which you can go up and over most of the mountains, unlike, say, the Rockies, where you have to find a pass. But these mountains, you can travel up and over them, but it is difficult. And if you've got, you know, a horse-drawn wagon or a donkey and a wagon, I mean, that helps, but, I mean, you got a long upward climb. It can be difficult. So they would often wind their way around between the mountains. So think of that as mountains, okay? You picture that in your mind? So Jesus goes partway up the slope of one of these mountains, right there, somewhere on the northeast side of the Sea of Galilee. Verse 3, Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. So actually his primary purpose there is what?
Teach
his disciples. That's why he's there. Verse 4, now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. This is the second time the Passover is mentioned in the Gospel of John, out of three total. Okay? It's specifically mentioned. Remember in the previous event when he healed the man at the pools of Bethesda, he was there for a feast, but that doesn't mention which feast. Some commentators think it was the Feast of Passover. Dr. Weinrich, who wrote that blue commentary, the one I'm primarily using, he thinks it was the Feast of Passover. But the fact that John actually mentions the Passover elsewhere in the Gospel would lead many to believe that that previous feast was not the Feast of Passover. Okay? Now, in terms of timing of things, does it really matter? If there's three feasts during the time of Jesus, the third Feast of Passover the three Passovers. The third Passover is the one where he's arrested and crucified. He is the Lamb of God. He's fulfilling the Passover. So then that means he would be ministering for 2.5 years. If that other feast that's mentioned is a Passover, then there's 4 Passovers during Jesus' ministry. So then he's ministering for 3.5 years. Typically we recognize that Jesus was preaching and teaching and doing miracles for how long?
3 years.
3 years. Well, if you take 2.5 and 3.5 and average them together, what do you get?
Three.
I'm bringing up a silly point because does it really matter?
Mm-hmm.
No. It's 3 years, whether it's 2.5 or whether it's 3.5. It's 3 years. We'll just call it that. We don't know exactly how long, after all. All right, so it's the Passover. Now, that's key for this upcoming miracle. This all is colored and flavored and reflected by the fact that this is the time of the fast Passover, which is the biggest of the feasts of the Jews. Passover is at hand. They are not down in Jerusalem, which that's where they should be. They should be down in Jerusalem to celebrate break the Passover, but they're not. Not all Jews could always travel to Jerusalem for every feast. Verse 5, lifting up his eyes then, and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" So, who's initiating the action here?
Jesus.
Jesus is. This is important. Jesus is teaching his disciples, and he sees the crowds trickling toward him. Streams and pods of people coming towards him. They see Jesus. They know that's where he is. And why are they going again? We know why they're going to see Jesus. For
miracles.
For miracles. For the healing that he's doing. Well, it's late in the day. A lot of times, you'd only really, in that culture, you might only have 2 meals in a day. You might have something in the morning when you wake up, break your fast, and then you'd have something in the evening. Now, if you were more well-to-do, middle class or above, you might have 3 meals in a day. So this is in the afternoon. We find this out from the other Gospels. It's late. The hour is late, meaning it's late afternoon. People are going to be hungry. So Jesus sees all of these people. They're a few miles from the nearest towns or villages. Where are we to buy bread? Verse 6. Aha. He said this to test him. For he himself knew what he would do. He said this to test him. Does God ever test us?
Yes.
All the time.
All the time, yeah. So this is not a temptation. It's not even, it doesn't even appear that way. It doesn't feel that way. It's not a temptation, but does God sometimes put us to the test? Absolutely. And so he's testing Philip here, and the disciples realize this after the fact. That's why John records it for us in the gospel here. Does God sometimes test us about, well, what are we going to do? What's going to happen? What's going to go on in life? And we don't know. And so God is testing us to trust him. I can think of a few events in my life where this is the case, where I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know what was going on. And, you know, later on afterwards, I realized, oh, God was just trying to teach me to trust in him, that it'll all work out. You know, a very minor example, for instance, and I'm sure all of you have examples of this too. You, God's faithful people. This has all happened to all of you. But, you know, at the seminary, and the bank account's running a little bit low, and I was working part-time while going to school. Jill was taking care of young kids, babies. We had 3 at the time. From age 5 to age 1. So she was kind of a stay-at-home mom. And, you know, a bill comes in, and how are we going to pay for it? And I'm not sure we have quite enough. And I don't get my small little partial paycheck for a little while yet. And then all of a sudden in the mail shows up a donation from some unknown church that we'd never contacted before. And they sent us a check for a few $100 just to support a seminarian. And it pays their bill. Jill will tell you stories about that. I think it worried her more than me because I figured, well, if I have to, I'll just go borrow the money. And then I know I'll pay it back. So I wasn't worried. You know, maybe for Jill it was a little more of a stretch. Things happen like that, don't they? I bet all of you have similar such stories. And God is testing us. Make sure you trust in him. He'll take care of you. He's testing Philip here. Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat? Well, Philip must have been an engineer because he's thinking logically here. That's what I would be thinking. 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough to give each of them a little. 200 denarii. Now remember, what is one denarii? Denarius. Denarius is a Roman coin. It was the equivalent of one day's wage for a common laborer. So a denarius, you know, like a common laborer today, let's say, what's the middle, I mean, just to kind of put it in terms. If you work 8 hours and you make $15 an hour, you're making $120. So in today's terms, just to round off to get us to think in the right way, a denarius back then, compared to today, call it $100. So 200 denarii, that's like, well, what, $20,000? $20,000? That's about the equivalent of what Philip is saying. If we had 200 denarii, here's another way to think of it, 200 denarii. If you work 5 days a week or 6 days a week for 50 weeks, 200 denarii is about half a year's wage. Half a year's wage. So if you were to be a common laborer today and make 40 grand in a year, this is 20 grand. See, the math works out. $20,000 in today's dollars would not buy enough bread for each person to just get a little. Well, we come to find out there's 5,000 men plus women and children there. So call it somewhere in the neighborhood, I would say, of 10 to 12,000 people. That's a lot of people. So you can understand, even if you had 200 denarii and were able to buy bread, there wouldn't be enough of that bread available in the surrounding towns and villages to buy. Everybody gets a little morsel, and that's about it.
Why do you think that he thought he had to feed them?
Who had to feed them?
That Jesus had to feed them food.
Well, I don't know that he thought he had to, but he knew he wanted to because of what this represented. You're about to see the deeper meaning in here as we get into this. Jesus knows. See, this is taking place during the Passover. And during the Passover, what happened? God provided for his people. They had to eat the Passover lamb quickly with your cloak tucked into your belt because you're going to depart quickly. And it was the final plague that got the people released from slavery. Then they passed through the Red Sea, and what did God provide for them in the desert? Manna. Jesus is doing this to show that he is the greater Moses. He is going to provide for the people as the Messiah. So there, I've given away a little bit of the ending. Okay, a little bit of the meaning. So did Jesus have to feed them? No, they could have gone a day without eating. You know, we can do that. Fasting. Yeah, that could happen. He didn't have to feed them, but he wanted to. Not only to show that he's the Messiah, a sign that he's the Messiah, but also to show that he is the new and greater Moses, that he is replacing the Passover. Okay? Make sense? Okay. All right. Was there a hand back up there or
something? I'm just thinking that, did Philip know how much was in their common purse or something? Maybe the 200 denarii? You know, like that's what...
Maybe.
He presumed they had.
Judas was the one who carried their money bag. We know that from elsewhere.
Right.
Why he asked Philip, I don't know. Yeah, he asked Philip. Philip, where are we to buy bread? Maybe Philip was the closest one standing to him. I don't know. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, so verse 8 and verse 9, there's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many? And I can't help but tell you, just a little bit humorous, I suppose. In my mind, I'm thinking, that boy has a wonderful mom. She packed him a lunch.
Yes. Yes, she does.
You know, he says, now think of a young boy here. So we're thinking like 10, 12. He says, you know, Mom, there's some people from the village that are going out to see that rabbi, Jesus. And you know, he does miracles. Can I go see him? Yeah, stay with the group from our village, but here's a lunch. Make sure you take this. 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. That's more than one boy would need for one meal.
Yeah.
So she's being generous to him, and he takes this knapsack, and I can't help but think, boy, what a great mom he has. She made sure he had some food, and apparently the only one. There were probably others that had food too, but they just didn't know it, or, you know, was tucked away or whatever. So, yeah, this little boy has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. Now, barley loaves. Anybody have barley bread before? I can't think that I have.
I don't know.
Have you had barley soup?
Yeah.
Barley soup.
Yeah.
Barley was considered the lesser grain. Wheat was the primary grain, and you would make bread from wheat mostly. Barley, I don't know if it was easier to grow or shorter time to maturity or if it had a bigger harvest or what, but they also grew barley in addition to wheat. And barley was cheaper to buy and it was cheaper to make bread from. It was considered bread for poorer people because they could buy a larger quantity of it for the same amount of money and so therefore make more bread. And barley, as you know, if you've had, you know, beef barley soup perhaps, barley is a coarser grain, so it's a little rougher. So it's not as fine and refined and smooth as wheat flour. Okay? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Now there's a connection here. The Jews used both wheat bread and barley bread in the Passover meal that they celebrated, the Seder Supper. Okay? They used both. So there's that connection. Also, fish. Now, what would you do with fish to preserve it? You'd smoke it or salt it. There's obviously no refrigeration. So you'd either have smoked fish or salted fish. This is likely smoked because they're farther from the Dead Sea or from the Mediterranean where you would get salt from. So it's probably smoked fish. How long does smoked fish last? Yeah, it lasts for a while. It's probably not fresh fish. So he's got a couple of fish, so there's protein, and he's got the barley loaves, and they're all around the Sea of Galilee, so there's plenty of water to drink. But what are they for so many? 5 loaves and 2 fish? That doesn't seem like much. And yet, what does Jesus say here? He says, "Have the people sit down." Now, there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Now, first of all, a few little caveats here. Have the people sit down is not precisely correct. Jesus said, have the people lie down or recline. Why is that a difference? Why does that matter? Is that a minor translation issue?
That's the position that they ate in.
Yes. They didn't have chairs back then. You guys remember this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you think about Asian cultures today where they have those low tables and you sit on cushions around the table and that's how you eat. That's part of this culture too. So they'd have low tables. If you went to somebody's house for a dinner or banquet, you'd have low tables, they'd have cushions, and you would usually recline. So you'd kind of sit on your, you lay on your side, you might sit up a little bit on your elbow, maybe you would sit up with your legs out, you know, kind of almost like we would say Indian style or whatever. But you're sitting on the floor. Chairs were very expensive. Wood is, you know, somewhat of a premium. You don't make chairs. I'm sure they had such things as chairs, but it just wasn't part of the culture. So recline or lie down. The reason this is significant, and it's a little unfortunate that the translation here did not get it correct. Jesus is saying, not just relax, sit down, I'll take care of it. No, he's saying recline, lie down, I'm going to feed you. That's the direct implication here. Now what's going on right now? The Passover. What's the biggest part of the Passover? The Passover meal, the Seder Supper. That's the key element of the Passover feast. Is being fed. And what does the Passover remind you of? Remind the Jews of?
Egypt.
And God giving them the manna in the desert. So the Passover is all about celebrating God's goodness of giving them manna in the midst of the wilderness. And here, they're out in the wilderness. Not really, but sort of. I mean, there's green grass there, it says. So it's comfortable enough. Jesus says, have the people lie down or recline. So that's a big deal. Also, I hadn't picked up on this till I read it from Dr. Weinrich in the commentary. Have the people lie down. There was much grass in the place. Think of those two verses, those two sentences, and then think of this with me. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. Oh my goodness. I never picked up on that before. Till I read it in the commentary. That's a direct connection, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Who is the good shepherd? A little bit after this, a couple chapters later, Jesus is going to say, I am the good shepherd. And Christians throughout history rightly connect that with Psalm 23. Jesus is the good shepherd. Well, right here, it's even a more direct connection that we often miss, even pastors. He makes me lie down in green pastures. If you translate what we just read correctly, what does it say? Have them lie down in green pastures. Right? That's incredible. All right. So what a wonderful connection there. So the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. 11, verse 11. Jesus then took the loaves. When he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated. Boy, what does that sound like?
The Lord's Supper.
Doesn't it?
Yes.
The early church had direct connections between this event, feeding the 5,000, and the Lord's Supper. And we still do today. Jesus took bread, gave thanks, and there's one thing missing here. It doesn't say he broke it, but it's very close. And it's actually the same root words in Greek, not the same form of the words, but the same root words. Took the loaves, gave thanks, and gave it to them. That word distributed can actually be translated as gave, which would make this an even closer direct connection in our minds to the Lord's Supper, Holy Communion. Okay? So yes, there is, John is using the language here, which again is lost in us in English. He is using the language of the Lord's Supper right there to describe what Jesus did. And distributed to those who were seated. So also the fish, as much as they wanted. Are you ever denied the Lord's Supper in our church? As much as you want. Do you realize you can come up twice if you want to? It does you no extra good. Okay, just so you know.
Right.
Pastor Hugh asked me when I first got here. Apparently Pastor Farrier did this. He would only take communion at one service.
Really? I don't recall that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's a little teaching moment in there to say that you really only need it once at a time, you know, per day, per week, whatever, because that's connecting you to Jesus, giving you forgiveness, giving you strength of faith, you know, Jesus' body and blood. So Pastor Farrier would only take it at one service, I think usually the early service. And then he did not take it at the late service. Hmm. I've known other pastors who do that. Pastor Q asked me, do I want to take communion at both services? When I was first here, brand new pastor. And I said, yeah, I want to take it at both services. I would make the confession that, you know, by my action of taking communion at each service, the greater action of the Lord's Supper is connecting you to Jesus. Okay? Jesus' real body and his real blood, in, with, and under, as we say, in some miraculous way that's hard to explain, the sacrament there, it connects you to Jesus. But what else does the Lord's Supper do? It connects you to who?
The whole church.
One another. That's why it's appropriate, as St. Paul says, to practice closed communion or close communion. So I said to Pastor Q, and he was fine with this, he takes communion at both services. I said, yeah, I'm the pastor. I want to take communion at both services because it binds me to the people, connects me to you. That's the secondary thing. Primarily, it connects me to Jesus. Okay. I have had people who have come and or called and asked me or said, I haven't had the Lord's Supper in a while. Maybe they've been sick, shut-ins, whatever. Can I have the Lord's Supper? And I said, absolutely. You want to do it right now? I will never deny anyone who's one of our members communion. Now, if you're not a Lutheran, now that's a different issue. I got to talk to you about what is communion and are you Lutheran or not, or what are your beliefs? So I got that's a slightly different matter. Okay, as much as they wanted. That's how I got off on that track. Sorry. It's too easy to get distracted, you know.
No.
And when they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples, gather up the leftover fragments that nothing may be lost. So Jesus is a good environmentalist, isn't he? No littering. Is that what's going on here? The fact that I'm asking if that's what's going on here means the answer is no, that's not what's going on here. This is not about Jesus just making sure they don't litter. Actually, what he's doing is, and if we continue to read just slightly, so they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. How many baskets?
12.
Is that a coincidence?
No.
No. What would 12 relate to?
12 disciples.
12 disciples. So in a practical sense, each disciple found himself a basket and went around and collected the leftovers. And they all got their baskets filled. So practically, sure, that makes sense. 12 apostles, 12 disciples, that is, they all filled a basket. What does that have for meaning later on in the church? It is in the Gospel of John, after Jesus rises from the dead, that he's on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, and he's there in the morning. They had gone out fishing, and what does he say? Come and eat, have breakfast. And what does he have? He has fish on a charcoal fire and bread for them. And then what does he tell them? Feed my sheep. Feed my people. That's connected to this. Jesus' provision of food, of bread for the people is so abundant that he's beginning the process right here of commissioning the disciples to go forth and feed the future church. Okay? You see that here? 12 baskets. They collected 12 baskets that nothing may be lost. And see, here's another key to what I just said. That word nothing is generic. It's not referring to the fragments only. We don't want to lose the fragments. What do we do with the leftover communion, by the way? Do we have any altar guild in here?
Somebody drinks it.
We used to have a pastor that asked us to put it in the refrigerator for him.
Sure. Sometimes when there's leftover wine, on a Thursday, for instance, I'll just drink it. Because what's considered the most reverent for the wine is you either consume it or it's poured out on the flowers, the bushes, right? You're not supposed to pour it down the drain because that's irreverent. We follow that. So the altar guild will go out the little back door there and pour it on the bushes. Okay? But what about the bread? Most churches, Lutheran and otherwise, that understand the Lord's Supper correctly, what do we do with the bread? We put it back in the container and use it the next time. 12 baskets left over so that nothing may be lost. Think of it this way, so that no one may be lost. That word nothing, I looked it up in the Greek, and it's generic. It means things or people. It's a broad term. It's a very generic term. So it's not nothing. It's referring not only to the fragments. Save the fragments. Hence, the church would save the leftover communion for the next time, which we do with the wafers as well. And other churches do too. Catholic churches do too, etc. So you not only save the fragments so that no one may be lost, so that those who were not there for communion that time may have communion the next time. Now, yes, we can consecrate or bless more bread the next time for those who aren't there, but you can also reuse the plenty that God has given you this time for the next time as well. So what is this pointing to? So that no one may be lost. Jesus' provision, not only for those people at that time, but for the future believers in him, the future children of God, would also be saved. And as much as possible, this gift from God is perpetuated. It's perpetuated. So that we are still part of this tradition. In a certain sense, I'm not going to claim that those fragments were then passed down and then whatever. No. But when we have the Lord's Supper, it is a continuation of this event, which is a replacement of the Passover. It's all taking place at Passover. So Jesus is providing for you what is most important, the forgiveness of sins, so that no one may be lost. You can translate that nothing as both. Nothing may be lost and no one may be lost. Okay? There's so much rich meaning here, isn't there? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is layers of meaning. So often we read it, read this story and say, oh yeah, there's another miracle of Jesus. And on the surface, you know, it points to Jesus being Messiah or God. It does. But there's more and more layers below that. Okay, deeper and deeper meaning. All right, verse 14. When the people saw the sign that he had done, there's that word sign again. John doesn't use the word miracle. The sign that he had done, they said, this is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world. Now, prophet is capitalized there. In the Greek, it's not. So, prophet. They had an expectation, the Jews did. I think they still do, actually, Orthodox Jews today. When Moses died, before he died, he preached a sermon. It's recorded for us as the book of Deuteronomy. I don't know if you remember or knew this, but the book of Deuteronomy is the final sermon of Moses, with the exception of the last half chapter, which was written by Joshua, which documented that Moses died and was buried. Okay? Otherwise, all the rest of Deuteronomy is Moses' sermon. And he tells the people, after me, there is another prophet who will come. Listen to him. Oh boy, doesn't that sound familiar? Who is that prophet to come?
Jesus.
They knew that was a reference to the Messiah. So the Messiah, they knew, would be the greatest of the prophets. Now, is Jesus the greatest of the prophets?
Yes.
Is he more than that?
Yes.
But he is the prophet, capitalized. So they were expecting a final and greatest of all prophets to come, and that would be the Messiah. Now, yes, throughout these... So far this year or so of Jesus' ministry, people are starting to think, is Jesus the Messiah? Is Jesus, what do you think he's the Messiah? What does that mean? Yes, still confusion. Is he the prophet? Is he the prophet who is the Messiah? Yes, we think he is. And so the people are saying, this is indeed the prophet. What is one of the signs of the last and greatest and final prophet? He will be greater than Moses. Moses gave us manna in the desert. Jesus is giving them bread and fish in the wilderness. So this is another sign that Jesus is greater than Moses. And the people see that. So they are partially correct in this. This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world. That is a correct statement. It's limited. There's more they need to understand beyond that. But it is correct. Now, unfortunately, they see this and make this statement, this confession. This is a confession. They make this confession based on what? What did they just experience? A full belly.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Now, Jesus feeds you. Does he feed you today?
Yes.
Do we pray thanks to God for, thanks to Jesus for giving us the farms and the farmers and the rain and the cattle and the truckers and the bakers and the stores and all the rest of that all comes from God, right?
Mm-hmm.
And many of us have been part of that chain at some point. That is a gift from God, all of that, to give us our daily bread. We give thanks for our daily bread. Lord's Prayer, right? Catechism. Does God give us all of that? Yes. Are you thankful to God because of your full belly? Yes. Cookies are wonderful.
Yes. Go out and play.
However, yeah, that's right. However, there's a lot more to it than that, right? If your faith in Jesus today is based on the fact that you know and trust God will feed you, well, that is a faith. And that's going in the right direction. But boy, it's just the very beginning, isn't it? It's not rich enough or deep enough. That's what's going on here. The people, that's okay, this is all right. Yeah, there's a lot more they need to understand. They're trusting in Jesus for the most simplest and selfish of reasons, because he fed them. All right, let's see. All right, verse 15. Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. So Jesus knows what's going to happen here. What are they going to try and do?
Making him an earthly king.
Well, if you have a prophet, you think he's a prophet, you know, starts out as a rabbi. Again, the whole point of the Gospel of John is, what is the identity of Jesus? Well, he's a rabbi, and we know he's a prophet, we think he's the Messiah, and he can miraculously feed all of us with 5 barley loaves. We need to make him king. He needs to be ruler over our nation. Again, what does that show you? What kind of Messiah were they looking for?
An earthly king.
earthly king, a political king, a military king, a king who would be a ruler over them in an earthly sense. Exactly right. Jesus sees that, so here again, what does he do? He withdrew again to the mountain by himself. That's happened already in the Gospel of John a number of times, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Jesus sees there's trouble or conflict or misunderstanding and he withdraws. So, yeah. All right, any questions or comments so far? I'm going to go a little bit further yet. What's our time like?
I was just thinking about how long it must have taken to feed all those people to pass out all that bread and fish.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's another connection with the disciples. When he, if we go back here, and yes, this absolutely has the language of the Lord's Supper in it. He took the bread, gave thanks, and distributed them to those who were, he distributed them to those who were seated. How did that happen? He gave it to the apostles, who gave it to the people. What do we do in the church ever since then, from the early church till now? Jesus puts himself, when we quote his words, he puts himself in with and under the bread and the wine, and then what happens? The equivalent of the apostles then, which would be your pastor, mm-hmm. distributes it to you. Okay? Comes, that's part of the reason why we would confess, as do many other churches who properly understand the Lord's Supper, that communion has to have a pastor. You know, you can't have communion without a pastor.
Right.
Because that's fulfilling what Jesus is doing here. Among other reasons. Other reasons too. Okay. Alright. How did I get off on that? Does that make sense? What was your question?
I was just asking about how long it was going to take to feed them.
Yeah. So 12, yeah. Thank you. I don't know. I'm getting off on these sidetracks. Sorry. Is that an issue with age?
Oh, no.
No? So 12 apostles. Call it 10 to 12,000 people. Yeah, it would have taken a while. Hour or two. I mean, you're going around with baskets and you're distributing it. Jesus is breaking and breaking and there's more and more. And he's just baking these, filling these baskets and off the disciples go. They're distributing it to the people. Yeah, it would have been an hour long or 2 hour long event. Yeah. But keep in mind in that culture too, that's how long it was. You didn't go to somebody's house or banquet. Remember, lie down on the green grass. Recline, he's feeding them. This is a banquet, you know, language. So you didn't go just for a quick bite to eat. That was not what you did in that culture. You went and you visited and you stayed a while. That's how you communed with somebody, fellowshipped with them. So yeah, they're not in a hurry like we are today in America. Everything today is in a hurry, aren't we? We are busy, fast little people. Always running around doing stuff. There was a hand up here. Was it you, Linda?
I think part of the miracle is of having the 12 baskets.
Yes, it is. Starting out with 5 loaves and having 12 baskets left over? Yeah, that's part of the miracle, absolutely.
It wasn't a fast food joint.
No, it wasn't a fast food joint. Yep, you took your time.
He had the people sit or lie down, and then he gave food to those who were seated. What's the significance there? If you were up walking around, you didn't get anything.
I think that might be reading into it a little too far.
No food for you.
I think everybody would be seated. Now, would somebody occasionally get up, maybe walk down to the water's edge to get draw some water? They might have. So is there people standing up here and there, maybe to go find a bush over the hill over there? They're generally seated. And they know the culture, too. If somebody invites you to your house or invites you to a banquet and asks you to recline, I'm going to feed you, that's part of the hospitality culture that's there. So, yes, they're generally going to be reclining on the grass waiting to be fed. That's just polite. So.
It said about the men were seated, and there were 5,000. So was that an easier way to count?
Yeah. You kind of count heads of families, the men, or, you know, yes. Most of the women or children that would be there would be with the father or the head of the household. So they would come as a little group. So, yeah, that was how you
sat
count.
Down and everybody
yeah.
Talk.
Right. Okay. Any other questions so far? Comments? All right, just give me a little bit more. We're going to touch on this last little brief, another miracle, another sign, and this is significant, and it's all connected. When evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat, and started across the sea to Capernaum. It was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. So Jesus, perceiving that they were going to try to force him to be king, and he knew that's not his purpose, that would completely destroy his ministry, so he withdraws probably farther up on the mountain by himself. He probably told his disciples, you stay here, keep order, you know, make sure you got all the leftovers gathered. And either they had the understanding he would meet them in Capernaum, or he may have even said that. I'll meet you in Capernaum tomorrow, or something like that. I'm going up the mountain to pray and have some solitude, you know, something like that. They, in either case, however it happened, they had the expectation they were going to meet him in Capernaum. Now, Capernaum's a couple of miles across the top of the lake there. You saw the map, right? Okay. It was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. So they launch into the boat. Well, let's go over there, and we'll wait for him. Hopefully he'll be there in the morning. I mean, you could walk during the night and be there, a handful of miles, 3-4 miles, whatever it is. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. Again, those of you who have been there or are going there, the Sea of Galilee is surrounded by these high hills or mountains. They would call them mountains. And so as a weather pattern would come over, the wind would come over the tops of the mountains, and it would stir up or create wind and waves very suddenly on the Sea of Galilee. This is one of those cases. We hear a few of them in the Gospels. So they're rowing, and now all of a sudden you got this strong wind against you. How frustrating is that?
Yes.
I can think of a few times when we're like in a canoe and a family camping trip, and you're trying to get from here to there, and all of a sudden the wind's blowing against you, and you feel like, are we going anywhere? And you can't tell, can you? And you kind of look at the shoreline and say, yeah, we're making very slow progress. You're going against the wind or against the currents. Mm-hmm. That's so frustrating. Well, that's what's happening here. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. It's coming right at them. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, so they're most of the way there, but not quite. They had rowed most of the way there. They saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming near the boat, and they were frightened. Why were they frightened?
They
thought it was a ghost. We know this from other accounts. This same thing, this same sign or miracle is mentioned in a couple of the other Gospels. They thought it was a ghost, which, you know, can anybody walk on water?
No.
Do any of you ever remember, I don't know if this, I'm really dredging back into a side story from childhood. I had an aunt and an, I have an aunt and an uncle. They, and their cousins, which were about the same ages as me and my sisters, they had an in-ground pool. Mm. And we would go over there and go swimming all the time. We loved it. At one point, they got these giant inflatable, they weren't, kind of like an inner tube, but it was a giant foot. Two of them. And you put your foot in there, and then you could try to walk on water. It was some little pool gimmick from the pool store.
Uh-huh.
And I remember we all tried it. Who's going to walk on water? And, you know, we're all Lutherans, so who's going to be like Jesus? Guess what? None of us succeeded. I mean, it's an in-ground pool, so you're walking on this, and you start to go out, and as soon as, you just got to hope you don't fall backwards.
Right.
Everybody went in. You can't walk. These giant inflatable feet. You can't walk on water. You can't do that. That was hard. Yeah, you can picture it. They look like Bigfoot feet. All right. So you can't walk on water. So this now is the fifth sign. The feeding of the 5,000 is the fourth sign. That's key. I'm going to come back to that as we wrap this up today, and then again next time. So here's the fifth sign or miracle that Jesus does. He's walking on water. They were frightened. But he said to them, it is I, do not be afraid. Now this is a horrible translation. Any guesses what it is Jesus actually says? I am. The Greek here is ego eimi, which is the direct translation of the word Yahweh from Hebrew into Greek. Unfortunately, I don't know who was in charge of the ESV, and almost all the translations do this. Can that be translated as, it is I? In a technical sense, it can.
Yeah, it's in the King James.
What does King James say?
He saith unto them, it is I, be not afraid.
Yeah, see, King James gets it wrong, too. And I'm not trying to say it's wrong, because that is a fair translation of ego I me, is the Greek two words, which means I am. So it is I. It's fair.
Yeah.
That's part of what Jesus is saying, but that's not what he's saying. By saying ego I me, and the early church readers would have gotten this, because they would have been reading this in the Greek. Jesus is saying what? I'm Yahweh. Look what I just did on the shore earlier this afternoon, and what I'm doing now. And I am coming to you. There's a lesson as well. Do we go to Yahweh? No. Does Yahweh come to us? Yes. Does Yahweh feed us? Yes. This is all taking place during what feast? The Passover. And how did the Passover begin? Yahweh coming to Moses and instructing Moses on how to free his people from what? Slavery. And then take them through the Red Sea and feed them manna. Do you see some direct connections here that John is pointing out to us in this gospel? That Jesus is Yahweh, and he comes to us, and he draws us out of slavery to sin, and he walks on the water, taking us through water. Baptism. And what did he do just before this? He fed them manna in the wilderness. Jesus is making a statement here, and John is, through many clues, literary and word and grammar clues, is pointing out that Jesus is God and the new and greater Moses, replacing the Passover. Now, all of this comes to fruition in the Lord's Supper, Good Friday, and Easter Sunday. And so you'll see reflections of all of this at the end of this gospel. Direct connections. It's all written by the Apostle John. He uses the same words, and so it all reflects. Okay? So that's what's going on here. Jesus says, very literally, I am, be not afraid. I am, be not afraid. And he's very emphatic about it. Fear not. That would be another way that this could be translated. Don't be afraid. You know, that sounds too gentle. Jesus is more forceful here in the Greek, because it's two words. Do not fear. That's what Jesus is saying. It's like he's commanding them. When God is with you, do you need to fear? No. Yet we often do, don't we? We need sometimes a preacher in the pulpit, who's not me, telling you very forcefully, do not be afraid. Put away that fear. God is with you. Emmanuel, God is with you. Absolutely. Then they recognized it was Jesus, verse 21. Then they were glad to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going. Now there's some dispute among some commentaries. Is this immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going? Does that mean another miracle? That all of a sudden, boom, the boat is there? Dr. Weinrich says, don't read into this, that one word, immediately, another miracle. It's just more a case of, they're most of the way there, they've been rowing for probably a couple of hours here, and so all of a sudden Jesus is with them. What happens? The wind dies down, the sea is calm, and they row, and they're like, in a matter of, you know, another handful of minutes or fairly quickly, boom, they're there. That's what that immediately means. Don't read into that another miracle. That's according to Dr. Weinrich. Okay, and then they were there where they were going. And then I'm not going to get started, just to point out to you, because we'll get into this in January when we meet again. But in verse 22, the rest of this chapter is Jesus teaching and preaching. On the next day, what happens? So, when we start again in January, the rest of this chapter, we're going to see what happens because of these two events. Jesus feeds the 5,000 and then walks on water. And therefore, what happens and how does Jesus explain it? That's what's coming up next. Okay? It's Jesus' sermon that is titled usually, I am the bread of life. I am the bread of life. So is it, what's most important that Jesus will feed to us? The bread that fills our tummies? No. The bread that fills our spirit, our soul. That is forgiveness and faith. That's more important. So we'll get into that next time, which is a very important sermon that Jesus kind of preaches and teaches.
Is this the same instance where tries to walk onto the wall?
No, that's a different event.
That's a different event.
Yeah, okay. That's a different event. Right. Okay. Good question. And by the way, back to a few closing things. Feeding the 5,000 is the only miracle other than the resurrection that is recorded in all four Gospels. Hmm. Also, I want to point out to you, because it was in the one commentary that I read, that feeding of the 5,000 does have direct Lord's Supper implications, Eucharistic overtones. Okay? And here's how. This is according to Dr. Weinrich in that primary commentary I'm reading. Number one, feeding of the 5,000 takes place during Passover. Number two, it is called by John here a sign. Now, a sign is not a simple miracle. In John's language here in this gospel, a sign is pointing to Jesus' identity and to God's provision. Does God provide everything? And does Jesus feeding the 5,000 point out what his identity is? Yes. Number three, who's the doer here? Jesus. Remember I pointed that out. Jesus is the one who's doing this and initiating it. That's what God does for us. Number four, this has all the language of an outdoor banquet. Lie down or recline on the green grass. Oh, and I've got a little note here in my notes. Here's another connection that the early church Christians reading this in Greek would have picked up on this. Psalm 78, verses 19 to 20. Psalm 78, verses 19 to 20. And the Jews recognize Psalm 78 as a messianic psalm. Okay, now look what Psalm 78, verses 19 and 20 says in English. They spoke against God, saying, can God spread a table in the wilderness? He struck the rock so that water gushed out and streams overflowed. Can he also give bread or provide meat for his people? That's a messianic psalm pointing to the coming Messiah. And what did Jesus just do? He just fulfilled that psalm. Mm-hmm. Did he give them bread in the wilderness?
Yes.
And meat?
Yes.
Fish?
Yes.
He just fulfilled that psalm. Incredible. All right.
Is the water there the spirit?
In that psalm? You know, that's a good thought. I hadn't thought about that. I always just thought it was water to drink. But yeah, it could be the Holy Spirit. That's a good thought. I'd have to ponder that. So my answer is probably yes. All right, back to where we were. I was talking about the connections, the direct connections between feeding the 5,000 and the Lord's Supper. So number four was that this is an outdoor banquet. When you go to the Lord's Supper, are you participating in the banquet of God, of Jesus? Yes. Number five, connection between them, is the Lord's Supper terms. He took, he gave thanks, and he gave. Direct words from the Lord's Supper, right? On the night Jesus was betrayed, he took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to the disciples and said. It's the same words. Also, number six, here's the last point, there were 12 baskets of fragments left over so that no one would be lost, so that it would take care of the future believers, the future people. So there's a connection as well to the Lord's Supper. Okay, so for many reasons, from the early church all the way down to the modern church, the feeding of the 5,000 is viewed as the beginning of Jesus fulfilling the Passover and replacing it with the Lord's Supper. which ultimately comes to fruition on Maundy Thursday. Okay? All right. That's enough time for now. Questions or comments?
In my Bible, there's a footnote that says that in all four Gospels where this event is documented, only this one, Jesus, distributes the food.
Well, yes, right. And the others, I think he does give it to the disciples more clearly. Here it just says he gave it to them. So who's Jesus is the one giving, but who's he giving it to? We know from the other Gospels he's giving it to the disciples to give to the people, but yes, it's unclear here.
Well, so, I would think that he would need their help.
Well, absolutely. He can't distribute to 10,000 people on his own. Right. All right. Questions or comments? All right. Remember, 2 weeks off now. And spread the word to, maybe there's a few others that weren't here. I had a few regulars I see are missing. Spread the word. We'll meet again the first week of January, January 4th, or whatever that Wednesday is.
Okay.
1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, 4th. January 3rd and 4th. That's when we'll start again. And I'll have both classes in sync. All right, let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good day.